wrestling fans, this is Al Getz with another episode of Charting the Territories. As a matter of fact, this is the third to last monthly episode of the Charting the Territories podcast because I am going to announce now the final episode will be in September. And I plan to go out with a bang, and joining me for that bang, as always, is John Boucher. John, how are you this lovely July day?
Bang, bang, bang. I'm banging on here.
He's banging away.
Enjoying the summer.
Yeah, so you guys have a pretty hot one from what I understand up in New York.
It was a hot one. It's been hot. It's a little better today and it's supposed to start raining. Of course, it's like, you know, it's I hate to complain about rain and stuff like that when there's people way off than way worse off than us in here. But supposed to get some rain in the next couple of days. So, yeah, so take what we can.
Take what you can get. All right. Yeah. Well, this month on the podcast, we will be focusing on some of the more well-known little persons to have competed in pro wrestling in the early 1970s, with a focus on the man who ruled them all, both in character name and legitimately behind the scenes to some extent. That is Lord Littlebrook. We're going to have a special guest joining us. That's author David Gibb, who is going to discuss the life and career of Lord Littlebrook with us. And Dave is also going to be John's challenger this month for John Plays Gordon Solie's Championship Wrestling Trivia.
Ooh, baby.
Now, for our listeners, a little behind-the-scenes sneak peek. Originally, I was not going to announce ahead of time that Dave was going to be John's challenger. And we were actually going to surprise John unannounced, where Dave would challenge him to trivia. However, we had to reschedule the podcast when we recorded it. It's not too hard getting John and I together, but every time we seem to add a third person to the mix, it sometimes becomes difficult to stay on track. So when we had to reschedule it, I said, you know what, because John was nice enough to reschedule, I'm going to let him in on the secret.
Like a prep.
Yes. Also because I want John to win, so I want as few surprises as possible. Now, aside from the trivia segment, we will have all our other regular segments, including This Month I Learned. And as usual, we will kick things off with stuff John bought me off eBay. So, John, this month you bought me a negative.
Yes.
Usually he sends me positive things, but this time he sent me a negative thing. But it is a negative, i.e. a photograph negative.
Yes.
And it is of the man we will be focusing on this month, and that is Lord Littlebrook.
To our listeners,
I will post a picture of the picture on our social media channels, including Blue Sky at algetz.bsky.social and on the Charting the Territories Facebook page. So, John, tell us a little bit about this negative. Do we know who the photographer was?
That looks like one of those Lanza photographs, if I recall correctly.
That is correct. Based on there's what we would call a watermark. It is Tony Lanza, who is very well-known and well-respected photographer, a former wrestler who became a photographer. So he's like the Randy Johnson of pro wrestling.
Yes.
But he probably did not kill any birds. I think that was what was the guy in Stampede who always talked about the birds? Oh my God, his name is escaping me. Oh goodness gracious! Well, anyway, John, tell us a little more about this this negative, this photo, and what you know about Tony Lanza while I look that up.
Well, these were. I've seen, I don't want to give away my eBay secrets, but I found this one seller selling a bunch of those. And I wasn't sure if those were, and I'm still not 100% sure if those were originals. Or a lot of times you'll see what are essentially photographs, negatives that were taken from another photograph. So I'm not exactly 100% sure of the origin of this, judging by the size, it looks like it might be an original. I don't know. I would love to maybe someday get a scan of it to see if it's the real deal. You can usually tell. I've been duped a few times in the past, and you can usually tell by doing a super high res scan and zooming in on it to see if it's actual photo of a photo or the real deal. So
it could be. I don't know enough about photography and whatnot, but It looks like it could be an original and not a photo of a photo. The wrestler whose name escaped me, by the way, was Tiger Joe Tommaso.
Ah.
So in his promos, he would talk about things like, the birds told me to do this, the birds told me to do that. And a couple of years ago in this podcast, we talked about a funny story, and this was from a fan's firsthand point of view, and we verified it with a newspaper report. A fan brought a box of birds into a show that Tiger Joe Tommaso was wrestling at and released them during his match.
I remember this now, yes.
And the birds, who were surprised and startled, did something that birds often do, and that was start taking shits all over the ring and perhaps the ringside fans.
I also sometimes do that when I'm surprised or startled.
So another good reason why I'm glad we are not surprising you with the trivia challenge this month, because who knows how that would have played out.
Yeah, I'm wearing shorts. It's fine.
Well, that's good. So yeah, this is actually a pretty cool negative of a photo of the subject of this month's podcast, Lord Littlebrook. And just a note, so at the beginning, I referred to the wrestlers as little persons. Of course, at the time, they were referred to as midgets. That has sort of fallen out of favor, that term. I'll probably throughout the podcast alternate between the two terms. And truly, I hope you understand that we're using the vernacular that was used at the time. That most of those wrestlers have gone on record and said it didn't offend them, and to the, you know, even in later years they were okay with being referred to as midgets. So midgets, little persons, whatever you call them, they were an integral part of pro wrestling in the early 1970s. And we're going to celebrate wrestling history later this month in Waterloo, Iowa. Well, I am, because I'm going to be at the Tragos Thes Hall of Fame induction weekend from the 17th through the 19th. But we have some unfortunate news, and that is that John Boucher is going to be unable to arrange his busy, hectic life to attend Waterloo again this year. John, you will be sorely missed. I know Bo James was looking forward to going dumpster diving for some late night pizzas with you again this year.
Maybe 2026 we can do that again.
But also this puts us in a little bit of a pickle because of course the idea was to build up to a live trivia challenge between you and Chad Olson. So to Chad, who I haven't actually, Chad, this is probably the first he's heard of this unless I message him between now and when this podcast comes out. But we're going to have Chad come on the podcast in August, if we can schedule and allow it, because I've got an idea of how to end the territory since we are finishing up charting the territories. I have come up with a great concept that has already killed at least one wrestling territory. So I think it would be a great way to end charting the territories as well. Of course, my books will be available at Tragos and Thes in Waterloo, or you can buy them online at Amazon worldwide, or if you live in the continental U.S., the lower 48, which makes no sense because Hawaii is lower than the lower 48. But if you live in the continental U.S., you can order autographed copies of my books while supplies last at chartingtheterritories.com. And as I mentioned earlier on Blue Sky, algets.bsky.social, and the Charting the Territories page on Facebook. I also want to thank everybody who's reached out to me since last month's episode where I did announce that I was retiring as a wrestling historian. I really got a lot of positive feedback and people who were supportive of my decision, which honestly, in some ways, was a mental health challenge and struggle that I was dealing with. And while it certainly pales in comparison to many people's struggles that they're going through, I do want to say, it's okay to ask for help. It's okay to not be okay. But overwhelmingly positive feedback from a lot of our listeners, a lot of my friends. I actually had kept this pretty close to the vest for a few months, and really was, nervous as to what the response was going to be. And of course, a lot of people are upset, and there are a handful of people that think this is some kind of a swerve or some kind of an angle, and that I'll come back as the mass midnight podcaster. All I have to say to that is, we'll see. if it is a swerve, I'm not gonna spoil it right now. So yeah. I guess, you know. But yes, the final episode will be airing in September. So we've got this month, we've got August, and we've got September. Of course, this month we're focusing on Lord Littlebrook. But for the final 2 months, we're actually going to talk about one of the great what-ifs in pro wrestling. A wrestler who seemed to be on the rise and headed towards perhaps the next level of stardom in the ring, but definitely behind the scenes as well, when tragedy struck in early 1975. And that is Bobby Shane. We're going to spend 2 months looking at his life and career. In August, we're going to focus on the first 5 or so years of his career, when he was presented as a clean-cut babyface, billed as a boy wonder. And then in September, we're going to look at the last 5 years of his career, when he transformed drastically into a heel, a cocky heel, known as the King of Wrestling. I've also recently decided to post an excerpt from one of the two unreleased books that I had been working on earlier this year. It's a spotlight on one of the great sleazy underbelly type characters who was prevalent in wrestling in the 70s and 80s, and that is Yellow Belly Buck Robley. It was written for the Heart of America book, so while it does talk about his background and some of the other places he worked and managed and booked, there is an emphasis on his 2-year run in Heart of America, aka Central States, in 1977 through 1979, where he and his army ran roughshod over the baby faces in Kansas and Missouri. Also, a lot of the other documents that I had originally put on our PayHip website are now on chartingtheterritories.com. And all of these, you can actually view them in the web browser or download them for free as a PDF. And a lot of these are basically the early stages of what became my wrestling almanacs, the books that I've released. So if you want to actually see how my writing style or how, you know, my tracking of these stats, the spot rating and everything else, how it progressed over the last several years, you can go to chartingtheterritories.com and check out some of my earlier work and download them for free. There almost certainly won't be any other excerpts from the book posted, but what I did do is I shared all my clippings from the second half of the 1970s for both Heart of America and for Leroy McGurk's territory with our pal Chris Knights, who's an editor for WrestlingData.com. So gradually over time, he's going to add them to WrestlingData.com. As a matter of fact, by my count, I sent him like 5,000 clippings for about 5,000 shows, of which about 1,000 of those are not currently on Wrestling Data or any other results aggregator sites.
Wow.
So he and I continue to add to the growing number of shows that are finally documented online, that many of these had not been documented since they happened 50 years ago. One of my goals with Charting the Territories has always been to provide factual and accurate information about pro wrestling. And the reason I chose to do that is because not a lot of historians and even authors were doing that. They were relying on the tall tales told by wrestlers. But there are a few authors that do a great job of getting down to the facts, aside from our fiction, right? Fiction author David Gibb, who does a great job of creating fictional stories that yes. really capture the essence of pro wrestling in the territorial era. Indeed. Another great author is Ian Douglas, mm-hmm. who has written biographies on Bugsy McGraw, Brian Blair, Black Panther, Jim Mitchell, several others. He just released a new book.
Yes.
And it's called A Decided Novelty, The Essential Guide to Black Pro Wrestling History, 1880 to 1950. Given that so much of the history of black professional wrestlers is focused on Bobo Brazil, Bearcat Wright, and those who came along after them, this book will serve as a great guide to the many other names and faces that served as pioneers and laid the groundwork for those who came after. John, have you read that book or any of Ian's other books?
I have read all of them, except for I don't have the most recent one yet.
Okay,
I've not ordered that, but I can vouch for the quality of his other work. Yeah, the one he did about, but the Barbados, is that the other one he did?
Yes, yep.
Amazing. Like,
what was it? Barbados, Bahamas, something like
Bahamas,
that.
Bahamas, something. Yeah, Barbados, Bahamas. Let's call the whole thing off.
Kokomo, ooh, yeah. I want to take you.
That's
come excellent. On, pretty mama.
Excellent book.
Yep. Before we dig into the little persons, we're going to circle back and talk about one of the big persons who we talked about a couple of months ago. We were looking at superstar Billy Graham. And when talking about his pre-wrestling life, we talked about some of his track and field exploits. And I had said that we were going to compare Graham's records with the discus throw to that of Kerry Von Erich's. And I actually forgot to do that, but we're going to do that now. So in a 1966 article in the Arizona Republic, it talked about Graham's high school accomplishments, including a discus throw of just over 164 feet. So, John, do you think that was more or less than Kerry Von Erich's high mark with the discus?
Less than.
And by a lot, by a little, by a moderate amount? Take it. Can you gander a guess?
Oh, I'm going to go... but somewhere between moderate and a lot. I think, okay. I think Kerry was like held like a record, like a state record that held for a few years.
He did. Yes. He did hold a record in the state of Texas. Now I looked solely through the high school years, to compare it to Graham's high school, number of 164 feet. And the highest discus I could find was a little over 190 feet. So, yes, a significant margin above that of Graham, which just goes to show you, you know, if in 1966 they were crowing about 164 feet for Billy Graham, what Kerry did a few states over a decade plus later is really, really impressive. And I think Kerry's record doesn't hold up. But, of course, most records like that, just over time, people are – bigger, better, faster, stronger, but I think it's still like second or third of all time.
Yeah, it's on the list. Yeah, I think he held it until I think he set the record in. I want to say I have an old newsletter, and it had a bunch of clippings with Kerry on the cover.
Yeah, well, based on his age, it would have been at the latest the mid 70s, and probably the early 70s, early to mid 70s would have been when he was in high school.
And I think that record stood. High school record for like 10 years. I think it was the late 80s when someone finally broke it.
Yeah, that's very impressive. Yep. Kerry could throw that discus. Also, if you listen to the latest Between the Sheets, I got off an incredibly tasteless Kerry Von Erich joke. So be sure to check that out. Now, last month on this podcast, we talked about the state of women's wrestling in the early 1970s. And this month, we will be talking about the other primary special attraction, the little persons or the midgets, depending on what term you use. That unfortunately means we won't get to talk too much about any bears, although we have talked about some of the bears in the past, because I think we talked about Dubois. We talked about one of the two main bear trainers.
Yeah, so, we talked about Tuppy Truesdale once too.
Okay, so we talked about the two of the primary trainers of bears in pro wrestling. But now we're going to focus on the midgets. So really what happens, similar to the women, a group of little persons, typically four at one time, are going to be in a territory for about a couple of weeks. And it really depends on the size of the territory and how many shows they ran per night. But the general idea was that they would appear in all the major towns in the territory. So if it's a small territory like Vancouver that only ran one show a night, they're probably there for a week. In a larger territory like Crockett or Lira McGurk, they're probably there for 2 weeks. It's not always four. Sometimes it's two. But really, it's just amazing to see how, because it's not the same four traveling cross country. It is four guys will go down to Louisiana, wrestle for a couple weeks, and then you know, on their day off on the last Sunday, they drive back to Missouri, and then they're put in new car loads with different groups of four going in all different directions. Now there are some geographic concessions. I mentioned Vancouver earlier. When the special attractions, and this isn't just the midgets, but also the women, when they were sent out to the Northwest, they would typically do one or two weeks in Portland, then 1 week in Vancouver, and then sometimes even a week again back in Portland. So, for example, if maybe they'll do a week in Portland, a week in Vancouver, and then a week in Portland, or they'll do 2 weeks in Portland, 1 week in Vancouver. Huh. Again, this way they get to hit all the major towns in each territory once on their way. And because it doesn't make sense to go all the way to Portland and then back to Missouri and then go to Vancouver, this is why when you see a troop of four little persons in Portland, you're bound to see the same four in Vancouver. Yeah. But in most other places, that was not the case, that the group that was sent to different territories was shuffled every single time. And much like with the women wrestlers of the era, there was one primary troop. Of course, the women, most of them were based out of South Carolina, where the fabulous Moolah controlled them, perhaps in more ways than one, depending on whose stories you want to believe. And here we have the troop of little persons controlled by Lord Littlebrook. Now, his real name was Eric Tover, T-O-V-E-R. Is it Tover or Tovey?
Tovey was a Y.
That's right. Tovey was a Y. There's our guest. There's our guest, David Gibb, joining us. So he's actually been listening the whole time. And we haven't said anything wrong yet, so that's good. I think I knew it was Tovey, but on my outline it says Tover, and I think that was just a typo that I didn't catch. But he, according to some of the stories about his life, he left an abusive household at a young age and joined the circus. And not long after a circus career began, he found himself in a little, no pun intended, trouble with the law. So, John, you found an article about some shenanigans that Lord Littlebrook got into early on in his time in the circus.
This is from the July 17th, 1948 edition of the wonderfully named South Wales Weekly Argus and Monmouthshire Advertiser.
That's a mouthful right there.
Yes, it is. Young Eric Tovey and a fellow circus artists are fined for duck theft.
Duck theft.
Duck theft.
D-U-C-K.
Yes. Yes.
Not T-H-E-F-T.
Yes. Not F-U-C-K. D-E-F-T. I'm not even going to try. Wonderful headline here. The duck that did not get across.
So what's the story here? What happened that they were fined for the theft of a duck? John can't even get it out.
There was a tattle. It was a tattletale. A little tattletale. A little schoolboy. Just, you know, there was a bunch of ducks crossing the road. And, these guys are riding by. And the last duck in the line, they little plucked the duck off the road.
They plucked the duck. Well, fuck.
And, and they claim that it was knocked down by a lorry, which I guess that's a truck, correct? A lorry, a British truck?
I believe so, yes.
I've only, the only time I've heard the word lorry used, I believe, is in like, the Beatles song, I Dig a Pony. I think John Lennon uses the word lorry, and I think I remember having to look that up years ago. I think it's a truck or something. Yeah. So, in trouble. And this is pretty close to when he, left for about 8-10 months before he left for the U.S. I think, right?
Yeah, so he's 19 at this point in time, yep. And so perhaps wanting to escape the law, who was on his tail for the theft of a duck, he hops on a ship and comes to America. If that's the case, that wouldn't be the first time he relocated because of legal troubles. But I guess we'll get to that
later.
In 1949, Eric Tovey departs North America, and you actually found some records. I guess this is records of people who were on the ship.
Yeah, this is kind of cool.
To North America. And what did Eric list as his occupation?
He's listed as a clown.
He's listed as a clown, which at this point in his life was entirely accurate.
Yes, and it's amazing that that was a viable career.
Yeah, so that is one little incident that led Eric Tovey on his path to becoming what I would say is one of the two most famous male little persons in pro wrestling history. I think, obviously, if you include all genders, I think Darling Dagmar probably breaks the top three, if not the top two. But I would have to say, if you ask the average Joe on the street to name little persons, if they are following the era that we cover, sorry, Hornswoggle, but you don't make the list. But I would say Lord Littlebrook and Skylo Low are probably the two names who would come up the most. And recently, our pal, friend of the podcast, David Gibb, did some research into Lord Littlebrook. So I figured I would have him come on the podcast to discuss him. Now, David is the author of How to Ace Your Comeback, a work of fiction set in the rough and tumble world of professional wrestling. And it's available for purchase at aceyourcomeback.com. At that site, he also has several serial short stories that he's put up over time as well. So, David, welcome to Charting the Territories.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast to be an extended part of the family for a while now, and here I am.
So, as my books have evolved from all charts and stats and results to chart stats results with a little bit of writing, if the writing is at all good, it is because of David, because he has been my editor, my sounding board, my throwing suggestions, my what the heck are you doing? Why are you writing in this tense here and this prose here and this way here? So I was never a great writer. I was an okay writer. Obviously, I'm a math guy, and it's often hard for someone to be good at both. But I think David's feedback and advice has made me a better writer over the years, but now we'll see how he is as a raconteur.
I'm a lot better on the page, Al.
So let's just talk a little bit more about Eric Tovey, aka Lord Littlebrook, and we can sort of go through the profile that you put together that John and I have seen. So let's just sort of hit the high notes.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you guys said, he started as a circus performer in England, and he kind of did the range of physical performing, a little bit of everything. He was primarily a clown, but also did acrobatics, did trapeze work, which a couple of other wrestlers like Bill Dundee have done over the years, and horseback riding, and just all sorts of circusy skills that ultimately led themselves to pro wrestling. And John, you were saying earlier that, like, you know, it's a little interesting that he got this career as a clown. That's a funny way to break in. But when he was young, like first during the Depression and then during World War II, especially during World War II, there was like a shortage of male entertainers, especially in the UK. Like so many people were tied up in the war effort that a lot of different people were getting into entertaining. And so he's really an interesting figure in that, you know, he starts his life in England during the Depression. He comes over here to the U.S. after World War II, and then he's here for basically the entire territory era. It's just super duper fascinating. I think he's got, maybe if you look at the territory era as a whole, he's kind of got one of the most complete runs of anybody who was there from almost the beginning to basically the end.
Yeah, and even in later years, he still pops up occasionally in the post-territorial era, like the mid to late 80s. You still see him from time to time. How does he go from circus performer to pro wrestler?
Yeah, so this is what I'm about to tell you. I obviously don't know by talking to him personally. He died several years ago. What I'm going to share with you stands on the shoulders of research that folks like Greg Oliver have done. He did a lot with Lord Littlebrook. Also the work of a woman named Betty Adelson, who is a psychologist and disability advocate and an expert on dwarfism. But she interviewed him extensively, and she wrote this kind of definitive book called The Lives of Dwarves, which traces how little people have fit into society kind of throughout history and everything. And he was one of the subjects who she actually, you know, it's a whatever couple hundred page book, and three of them are all about him. So she was kind of, or he was one of the kind of key little people who she wanted to sit down and talk to. He came to the U.S. As a circus performer, and then allegedly the circus that he was working for went belly up. So he was in a new country with basically no roots and no money and now no job. Somehow through the circus performer network, he gets connected with another British expat now living in North America, who would be Major Tom Thumb. not to be confused with General Tom Thumb, who was a P.T. Barnum attraction. But Major Tom Thumb was one of the original little wrestlers, one of the original midget wrestlers. And at the time, he was sort of the leader of the troupe, which Little Brook later became. But the two of them had a lot in common. Like, they were both from England. They both had background as circus clowns. Thumb was like 15 years older and, you know, 7 or 8 years ahead in the business. It was like the perfect situation for Toby to come in and be mentored by this guy. So he comes to North America in 49. He's got this sort of career crisis, but by 55, he is Lord Littlebrook.
And so he was he Lord Littlebrook from day one?
So he was Lord Littlebrook. In some places, he was Lord Clayton Littlebrook, adding some extra text to that. Other places, he was Roger Littlebrook. I think that was in Toronto, maybe he was Roger Littlebrook. But he went through by a number of related names, but he kind of settled exclusively on Lord Littlebrook rather quickly.
Okay. Now, we mentioned earlier, aside from Littlebrook, perhaps the other most well-known little person of this era on the men's side was Skylo Low. So at what point did Littlebrook and Skylo Low cross paths?
Pretty much immediately. That's what's so crazy, is he was right in the thick of this stuff. Like, within his first year of wrestling, he's already wrestled in Michigan, in the Gulas territory, in Toronto, in Charlotte, in Georgia, in Florida, Texas, Southern California, Kohler office in the Midwest, Toots Montz in Manhattan. So he's wrestled all over in the first year, and he's already wrestling against the people he'd be most famous wrestling against. So frequently it'll be a tag team of he and Little Beaver against Skylo Low and Fuzzy Cupid. And that's a very famous match that's on cards all over North America, from the very, very Northeast to the very, very Southwest, pretty much. So that was a big one that he was involved in from the very beginning. He was just like right in the thick of it. Like you said, it was a very tight knit group, and he was identified early on as like a very promising performer.
Have you ever seen a photo, and this is both for you, David, and for you, John, have you ever seen a photo of Fuzzy Cupid?
Yes.
I think I may have.
All right, John, can you describe it? Can you describe him?
I could describe him better off the air.
he kind of looks like a caveman.
He does. He has it almost. It looks
like, what was it, Land of the Lost?
Oh, like, yeah, the little Shaka?
Yeah, something like that. Yes. But yeah, that is what he looks like. And I'm going to assume that, you know, this was by design, but his name, just such an interesting name, Fuzzy Cupid.
Yes, and he had like sort of the hair like a troll doll almost.
Yes. Now, one of the issues with trying to track these guys' careers and over a several decade period of time is that wrestling records, it's not that just that they're incomplete, it's that they're inconsistently incomplete. And there might be years in the late 50s where we have a much higher percentage of, you know, shows documented, and then a couple years later we're missing huge swaths of them. So when you try and look at how many matches he wrestled over the length of his career and how they ebbed and flowed over time, it's sometimes hard to draw conclusions from that, but it is very clear that as his career progresses, he's wrestling less and less. And this is because he is taking on more responsibilities behind the scene. So he, I think David, you had mentioned that Tom Thumb at some point retires. And so does Littlebrook sort of take over the management aspect that Thumb was doing?
Yeah, this is something that, as far as I can tell, this like transition of power was never publicly documented, right? Like, this is like not just the wrestling, not just the circus business, not just the wrestling business, but like the little person wrestling business. This stuff was played very, very close to the vest. Sure. It does seem like it occurred sometime between 62 and 66, somewhere there in the mid 60s. It's logical that there would have been some sort of a gradual transition with like a mentor, but we don't know the exact moment it happened. But by 66, he's sometimes billing himself as the NWA World Midget Champion. And I would say that means he is definitely the boss by 66.
That sort of makes sense, much in the same way that Moolah, for most of her time as the head of the troupe, was, of course, the champion as well. So yeah, that does make sense. And at this point in time, the troupe is based out of Ontario. And you have a little bit of info about how he was training these wrestlers. So let's briefly go over the training course that he had for prospective wrestlers.
based on what I have read from interviews with him, he was extremely proud that it was a rough and tough crash course, that he would bounce you out as quick as he decided that you were not cut out for it. And that as soon as you had even the fundamentals of the fundamentals, you were on the road. And he said that that's how he was trained and that's what worked for him. So he tried to pass it forward in that way.
All right. Do we think he's doing Hiro Matsuda type stuff where he's breaking guys' legs on day one to see if they come back? Or
he trained big guys and little guys, and I bet he let the big guys have it. When you read interviews with him, he was a surly guy, no doubt.
Yeah, certainly. I think Ed Wiskoski and Butch Reed are perhaps the two most well-known big wrestlers for whom Littlebrook was at least partially responsible for training them. And I think Wiskoski has some good quotes from an obituary on Slam Wrestling, the obituary for Littlebrook. I think Wiskoski has some good quotes there. So the troupe is based in Ontario at this time. However, by the early 70s, they relocate to Missouri. And this is almost certainly because of an incident outside the ring and inside the bedroom that happens. So David, let's talk about the dark side of the ring, the juicy gossip. Yeah. What's going on here?
Yeah, this is one of those things there. Again, I want to put the
caveat.
Exactly. Thank you. The caveat that this is almost impossible to verify. And I tried really, really hard in terms of things like Canadian court records. I mean, maybe someone who's Canadian who has better access to that system can prove this all. And that would be amazing. But allegedly, as a wrestler, as a performer, someone who lives on the road, he's gone for long stretches of time. And maybe one of those things happens where he comes home maybe a day or a few hours earlier than was anticipated. And he finds his wife in bed with another man, and not being one to suffer such things. He pulled out a gun and shot the guy in the heart, I believe. Ooh. Or narrowly missing the heart, as the tradition goes. So shot him in the chest. And he ultimately does go to trial for this. And if the tradition is true, he gets off more or less scot-free because the judge sees him and sees the victim, who is ostensibly a full-size person of typical height, and hears about the situation. Says, well, geez, we can all relate to that. Plus, this guy's got this other level. And so allegedly, he gets off like more or less scot-free and absconds to the United States, where he reopens camp in St. Joe.
So they're saying the judge said, well, I do the same thing, so I can't. It's really hard to. It's totally different, but that reminds me of the alleged lost episode of Married with Children that involved a legal case with a ridiculous conclusion. Are either of you familiar with this?
I'm not.
I'm all right.
So as the legend goes, in the first couple of years of Married with Children, it was raunchy, but in a different way than it became later. So as the story goes, there was a lost episode where Al and Peg go to a motel, and the motel has videotapes for them to watch, I guess, to put them in the mood. Ooh. As it turns out, these videotapes are from filming at the motel. The motel was filming couples and then using those videotapes to have other people. And so it turns out Al and Peg then get filmed themselves in the act of coitus, and they decide to sue the motel. But the judge determines, after viewing the videotape, the judge determined that the act was so short he couldn't tell if they actually had intercourse or not, and throws out the whole case. Now, this is kind of the opposite of that, is that that the judge feels that what happened was perfectly reasonable and justifiable. But anyway, the good thing about relocating to St. Joseph, Missouri, is that you are literally in the center of the United States. And this brings up a point we talked about, that the little persons would be everywhere on the East Coast, West Coast, Southwest, so on and so forth. Based on some of the things I've read, it appears that they're driving virtually all the time, that when they're in Portland or Vancouver, that they've got to somehow get from Missouri to Vancouver. And of course, this means they may have been booked in Nebraska or somewhere along the way. But these guys are putting on lots of miles, because I guess, every now and then you can fly in a wrestler, but if you have four midgets booked, that's a lot of money to fly all four of them in, as opposed to putting all of them in a car and having them drive out. So it's just fascinating to really get almost proof of how much driving was going on. You know, a lot of times we hear wrestlers talk about how much of the time they drove and like, oh, you're exaggerating. But in this case, because they weren't headquartered in any one territory for a 6-month run, they've got to go from, you know, Missouri down to Louisiana for 2 weeks, then back to Missouri to reshuffle the deck to then find a new carload and shoot out to Georgia or, you know, Minnesota or whatever.
Yeah, I know that he got a visit from the IRS 1 year because he had claimed over 100,000 travel miles just for himself individually. And they paid him a visit and he had the documentation, allegedly. This was a story that he gleefully told Betty Adelson when she interviewed him later in life. You know, once again, old Carney stuff. He was so happy that he was able to document all his miles to the IRS.
he laid it on the table and said, bam!
Exactly. He was ready for it.
And something else, as you're talking about that, the other thing he documented was his win-loss record. And again, this is further evidence that he's probably calling the shots for the little persons because his win-loss record in that 5-year period where he had 100,000 miles was?
Oh, from 67 to 71, he had 283 documented wins, 58 documented losses and 7 documented draws. So quietly, one of the winningest wrestlers right. in the world,
which probably means that he is the one calling the shots because he is generally positioned as a heel. Is this correct?
Or yes, no? Definitely. He would have been like an arrogant heel.
Yes. So yes, a royal heel. So as we've discussed in this podcast before, typically the baby face is won more often than the heels. So in this case, you know, we can definitely see that he has some stroke behind the scenes. So when does his full-time in-ring career sort of end, as best as we can tell?
Yeah. So he would have been approaching 50 as we get into the later 70s. And in early 77, there's definitely like a big switch where he goes down to Texas and he puts over the Mighty Adam a few times and loses the World Midget title to him. And that's kind of the turning point in his career. Before then, like we said, he wins almost exclusively. After that, he loses almost exclusively. He put over Wee Willie Wilson a lot. And the person who he lost to the most, especially during this period, very frequently was Cowboy Larry.
Okay. So he's winding down. One of the things that stood out to me when looking through some random results as you get into the 70s, there are times when Little Brook's name shows up just once over a couple of week period. But at the same time, he wrestles against someone like Cowboy Lang, who is in that territory for 2 weeks. So this suggests to me either they're flying Little Brook in for the big shows, because usually these happen at a big show, like the Bayfront Center in St. Petersburg. I think there was one time he wrestled in Arlington, Texas. So that would have been a big Texas Stadium show. Or he is traveling with the troupe, but not wrestling. So I'm not sure which of the two it is, but it points towards one of those two things being true. And that's something we actually see with the women in particular, is sometimes there's four women booked on the shows every night, but there's a fifth name that pops up from time to time. It's not always the same four. So I'm wondering if sometimes when a territory booked a troop of women wrestlers, they sent five. That way, if someone gets injured or if someone, you know, or they just need nights off every now and then, they can sort of mix that up. There are also times when I see a women's tag match has a woman referee. So this would be the wrestler that isn't wrestling. So I wonder if this happens more often than we know of, where instead of four, they're sending five and there's just someone on standby.
Yeah, I think that could have been the case. And one thing I'll actually add is just knowing what we know about the way these sub troops worked their way into the business, I think he would have liked to have been there to have handled the money. For if there had been any sort of a dispute with the promoters, any sort of a change, he would have wanted to be in the middle of that since he's the boss. And as was the case with Moolah, right? Moolah got paid and then distributed the money. So I don't find it hard to believe that maybe Littlebrook was there. You paid Littlebrook and Littlebrook distributed.
So there we go. So here are our great minds all working together to think of different aspects and different reasons why something might be true. I, of course, am thinking of the aesthetics, and David is thinking about the money.
There you go.
That shows you where my priorities lie. So
John, I've actually read somewhere initially when he broke in, I think he was the promoter. Jack Britton was the guy he was working for initially. And the initial split from Britton was when Littlebrook was doing the math and figured out like what percentage Britton was getting. And also the guy who was driving them around, mm-hmm. he was making more than the rest. So I think in my head, why would I pay this guy this percentage? I could just do this myself. So, yeah. So he's probably still doing that.
Perhaps so. He takes the money and then he distributes some to the wrestlers. And then he says, since I drove, you owe me this for gas and trans.
Yep. Exactly.
All right. So, he continues to train wrestlers, both big and little, but as he's trying to find, more little persons to sort of take over as the old guard is retiring, I guess he has to sort of look within to his own family tree to get some new blood. So David, we believe he had 6 children. Of those, how many donned the tights themselves that we know of?
That we know of? I believe it's 3. And it's his. Three. So he had 3 children who were of short stature, and then I believe 3 children who were of typical height, which is interesting mathematically. So little Cato and beautiful Bobby Dean were both his sons, and they wrestled with him extensively throughout the 80s in the later parts of his career. And then Luscious Lori, who is a lady smaller wrestler, is his daughter. And I believe she was on that show that Hulk Hogan did a decade or so ago. I think she might have been one of the people who was featured on that program.
So aside from the typical tag matches with the little persons or even singles matches, as Littlebrook is going towards the end of his career, he appears in 6-man tags or tags involving the big wrestler. So this is, this is a gimmick match that would happen every now and then. In fact, I've participated in them myself in the indies as the heel manager, where, me and the guy I was managing would challenge, the big fish wrestler and said, you could find anybody you want. And he would, show up with a little person. And of course I would sell for them because they're usually stiff as hell. And I'll say this, if they don't want to be body slammed, you cannot body slam them. I'm assuming it's the low center of gravity and physics of me having to reach down this and that. But let me tell you, if they don't want to go up for a body slam, they're going to make you look like a fool because you cannot do it. There's some that you mentioned here. When Lord Alfred Hayes was the manager of Super Destroyer Mark II, who was Sergeant Slaughter, they do some tag matches against the Crusher and Lord Littlebrook, which just sounds like fun. Not just a manager selling for him, but a character like Lord Alfred Hayes, who had that noble gimmick, but I could see him playing this up for comedy big time and just selling his ass off for Lord Littlebrook.
Yeah, when I was doing the research, this kind of topped the list of things I wish I had seen. definitely that he and the Crusher against Lord Alfred Hayes and Bob Remus. That was probably that was probably great stuff. He also at one point in Memphis, it was obviously kind of like Lord Littlebrook Day or something. They wanted to kind of give him a big win, so he won a battle royal in Memphis that had like Tommy Gilbert and Porkchop Cash and Orville Austin and Mike Boyette and Gorgeous George Jr. So he got to do all sorts of fun stuff. It seems like people really appreciated him being around, and that especially as they sort of started to sense that he was maybe working his way out, that they did some kind of cool different stuff with him.
Yeah, and so towards the end of his in-ring career, he shows up for some of the last remaining major players in pro wrestling as the territorial era sort of fades away. So tell us about his WWF run in the late 80s, and then also some of his non-wrestling appearances with national promotions.
Yeah, sure. So in 86, he would have been on the Wrestle Rock Rumble show, made famous by the music video, or at least if you're my age, famous for the music video. He and his group were on that show. And probably as a direct result of being on that show, they got the call to come to the WWF and to work for Vince McMahon. And I think that was probably really bittersweet, because based on every interview he sort of gave later in life, Littlebrook kind of knew that was the beginning of the end, that was the end of the trail, so to speak, that was the last place to go. And that really the business model that they had thrived on in the 60s and 70s was already dead. So it would have been kind of a bittersweet thing, I think, you know, through there in the 80s. But, you know, he participated mostly in tag matches by then. Like, he would have been close to 60 and with a lot of mileage on a small body. So he was mostly working in tag matches. He would team with Little Tokyo, and they would lose to Little Coco and the Karate Kid. That was kind of the most frequent one.
And he was in the famous WrestleMania 3 match.
Yes, wherein who is it? King Kong Bundy says, "I am going to kill this effing midget" at one point in that match. I think they might have edited that out at some point.
And so then, fittingly enough, his actual final match for the WWF came in the place where he had set up roots after escaping duck theft charges in England, and then after justifiable shooting of his wife's lover in Canada, and that is St. Joseph, Missouri. So he teams with Little Tokyo and loses to Chris Dubé and Little Cruz, but then he's back on TV in another role with another national promotion in 1990.
Yeah. So he started managing who had been the New Zealand Militia, Rip Hawk and Jack Victory. They became the Royal Family, and he was there. They were in that U.S. tag tournament with Brian Pillman and Tom Zenk. Again, that's probably their kind of one famous moment in WCW.
I think you mean Rip Morgan and Jack Victory.
Rip Morgan, I'm sorry, Rip Hawk and Sweet Hansen, right? Yeah, so I'm in a different decade here.
He probably was got in the ring with Rip Hawk and Sweet Hansen at some point. But
I'm sure he did.
Yeah, true, yeah.
And Rip Hawk probably would have taken the spot if you'd called him and offered the check. Yeah. so they were he was there with them through, I think, like Starcade of 1990-ish, and then just kind of faded away, and that was really the end of him in getting national attention.
Yeah, so John, do you have any questions for David about Lord Littlebrook, or do you want to try and stump him? Because since we're going to do our trivia segment shortly, maybe this is your chance to play some psychological mind games with him and show how much you know.
It's like, oh, I actually did find something that you might find interesting. I was doing some digging just over the weekend, and I did find a newspaper article that might be of interest. Let me see if I could pull it up here. Okay. This is about the marriage, extramarital exploits. Ah, mm-hmm. I found something from the Toronto Star from November 22nd, 1963.
Oh, here we go.
Which is a date that we know for something else, mostly. The headline, "Free Midget Wrestler." A four foot four midget wrestler who shot his wife's lover and then took pictures of him was acquitted yesterday on a wounding charge. And they actually talk about there was a jury. They deliberated for 3 hours. Okay. And found him not guilty. But my favorite part of this was that Tubby said he hid in a pantry with a camera and a rifle and watch John McDonald, 56 of Rural Road Number 4, Campbell Ford. I just give the guy's address.
Yeah, right.
Get in bed with his wife.
Wow.
He shot McDonald in the left arm and photographed the scene. When the pictures were exhibited in the court, John McDonald collapsed. And that's the entirety of the article. But I was excited to be able to find. I've never seen awesome. Anything like of this incident before. I don't know if this just came up in the newspaper archives, but I was so excited to find this just a couple of days.
Yeah, well, John, send that to me, and I'll post it, or you can post it on social media.
I'll send
as
it
well after
again.
This episode comes out. Yeah. We're going to talk a little bit more about Littlebrook, later, but I think now we're going to get to our trivia challenge.
Maybe.
We're going to play Gordon Solie's Championship Wrestling Trivia against David Gibb. So we're going to go over the rules. For the last few months, John has been competing against ChatGPT. So since he's competing once again against a human challenger, we will go over the rules. So both competitors will be asked all four questions on one card in sequential order. We are doing this via Zoom. So they are both going to write their answers on a sheet of paper. There will be a maximum 30-second time limit for each question. If both are done prior to that, we'll end it early. The correct answer for each question will be what is printed on the game card, even if we're fuzzy on whether it's truly correct or not. In rare cases, I may provide a little clarity on the phrasing of the question. Question one is usually related to the 50s and 60s. Question two is usually general wrestling knowledge. Question three is usually related to the 1980s. And question four is either true, false, or fill in the blank. And the fill in the blanks are usually, but not always, the name of a wrestling move or hold. Either contestant can ask for a hint for any of the first three questions, but a hint can only be used once. The hint must be asked for after the question is read aloud and before the time limit has expired. The clock will be stopped while I read out the hint, but no extra time will be given. So if you ask for a hint at 29.9 seconds, it won't help you because you'll have 0.1 seconds to write something. There'll be one and only one hint given. So if one contestant asks for a hint, neither of them will be allowed to ask for a hint for any of the remaining questions. I will ask them to show their answers, to hold up their sheet of paper simultaneously, and we will look at their answers and compare them to what's on the card. If both competitors answer the same number of questions correctly, there will be a bonus question for a tiebreaker. So, John, do you have any questions before we begin?
Nope, I'm good. I'm sweating a lot. Already.
All right,
sweating.
David, do you have any questions?
No, I am also sweating.
All right, now, of course, if John wins, everything is lined up perfectly for John to finally get his rematch against Chad Olson just as this podcast is winding down, making for a very compelling story.
Yes.
You got a thing you want to do.
If David wins, the whole damn thing is screwed up.
Who knows?
I love it.
No pressure. David, no pressure.
Do you understand what I'm saying here?
Oh, I'm picking up what you
do. I need to do a Luthez and take you in the back and have a little chat with you beforehand, or are you understanding of the assignment here?
No, I know what needs to be done.
I don't know if I like that answer or not, John. I'm now scared. I might have to fucking rip this thing again.
I'm gonna go make sure my door's locked.
All right. Let's play Gordon Solie's Championship Wrestling Trivia. Question number one. What was the name of the tag team composed of Buddy Roberts and Jerry Brown? John is writing away and David is pensively thinking.
I need to use my hint so that John can use it later.
All right, there you go. After about 8 seconds, David has used a hint. The hint is they came from the same place as Andy Kaufman claimed to during his Memphis run. Clock is restarted. Now David is writing and John is either done or now flustered by the hint. All right. John, are you ready?
I am ready.
All right. David, are you ready?
I am ready.
I think the hint helped David greatly. So I will ask both of you to hold up your sheets of paper and I will read what is on them. David, you're going to need to move it a little bit down.
How do I line up with the camera?
All right, there we go. All right. David has written The Hollywood Blondes and John has written The Hollywood Blondes. The correct answer, The Hollywood Blondes. So a very good use of the hint by David Gibb. And now we are tied up at one apiece. Question, and again, no more hints. So question number two. In a brass knuckles match, may you tape your fists? Both men look confused.
I feel like I just got hit with a pair of brass knucks.
In a brass knuckles match, may you tape your fists? 10 seconds expired, 20 seconds remain. All right, 10 seconds left. Are you both ready? Ready? John, are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Both of you, hold up your sheets of paper. Both men have answered yes, although David wrote a paragraph after it.
I said, in some territories, I think they're always taped.
All right. The correct answer is yes. Both of you have gotten it right. They didn't actually wear brass knucks. The tape fist was meant to replicate the impact that that a punch would have if you were to use the weapon. Now, of course, that being said, sometimes they were actually using brass knuckles. There were some, I think, in McGurk's territory during Murdoch's run there. I think they would do matches where at the 10-minute mark, a pair of brass knuckles would be thrown into the ring, and whoever got to it first could use it.
Ooh, I like that.
All right, we're all tied up as David Gibb is trying his best to fuck up my booking plans.
Go.
Question number three. Okay. Who was Pro Wrestling Illustrated Magazine's Rookie of the Year in 1984? The PWI Awards questions always trip John up.
And it looks like
they're tripping David up as well. All right, 10 seconds have expired. 20 seconds remaining. Rookie of the Year, 1984. John seems to be writing something. David is posing like Rip Hawk, like Rip the Profile Hawk. Got about 10 seconds left. David, David's video froze for a second. I'm kind of hoping the feed goes out.
No, that's just me.
When I call for everyone to hold up their answers and I just have to disqualify him. But all right, our time is up. Pens down.
I'm wrong.
David wrote Sting? Question mark, exclamation point, question mark. John wrote the Tonga Kid. The correct answer. All right, the hint for this question, let's see if the hint would have helped either of you. The Apter Mags love to put members of this family on the cover. The hint might not have helped either of them.
Was it? Is that too early for Mike Von Erich?
Yeah.
The answer is Mike Von Erich.
Yeah, very nice.
So, all right, all tied up. Going to question number four. And of course, if it continues to be a tie, there will be a bonus question that I have written, but I might change it to screw over David if he doesn't fucking follow the assignment.
This one's for all the marbles, unless it isn't.
There you go. Yes. Question number four. True or false? There are only 987 actual sanctioned wrestling moves as recognized by the NWA. Seems the answer is obvious, but because of that, maybe it's not so obvious. I don't know. All right. 20 seconds left, 20 seconds gone, 10 seconds left. Both of you have written your answers?
Mm-hmm.
All right, both of you have. I've seen the size of the NWA rule book. It's not a large book. But anyway, both men, hold up your answers. Both men said false, which means no matter what the answer is, we're going to a tiebreaker. Oh. However, the correct answer is false.
Okay.
So both John and David have correctly answered 3 out of 4 questions. So we're going to go to the bonus question. David is mad. He wanted to put John away now. He wanted to put him away because he knows he's worried now I'm going to screw him somehow.
No, I wanted to show up and embarrass you. Now it's like I maybe just kind of squeaked over, you know, but it's fine.
All right. And again, let me remind everybody, the well-laid-out plan that I had all set up and established was for John to win this month, therefore setting up the big finale against Chad Olson, the only man to beat him. And if, David, if you win, that screws it all up and makes me look like a fool. A fool!
Do you want
to make me look like a fool? That's up to you. So,
Here are
the rules for the bonus question. The answer to the bonus question is either a whole number greater than 0 or a date in month, day, and year format. It will be along the lines of how many times did this wrestler sell out Madison Square Garden, according to Dave Meltzer? How many different times did such and such win the Southern heavyweight title, according to Duncan Will's wrestling title histories? It will often, but not always, be in the wheelhouse of John. I will ask David the bonus question first, and he has 15 seconds to respond. I will then ask John if he thinks the actual answer is higher or lower, or in the case of a date, before or after David's response. So, David, you're up first. You have 15 seconds. The bonus question. According to the WWE's completely fictitious, fabricated, and fake historical record, on what date did Pat Patterson win a one-night tournament in Rio de Janeiro to become the first intercontinental champion?
Oh, no. See, I'm so bad with dates and numbers. This was just designed to give it to John at the last
minute. And you're wasting time because you've got 10 seconds left.
February 12th, 1978.
All right. John, do you think the correct answer of when Pat Patterson fictitiously won the tournament was before or after February 12th, 1978?
After. I believe it was September 1st, 79.
Not only does John say it's after, but he actually went ahead and tried to be a super, super smarty pants and gave the actual date. Now, it doesn't matter if he got the date right or not. All that matters is whether it was before or after. So John said it was after. The fictitious, fabricated, and fake date of Pat Patterson's Intercontinental Championship victory was September 1st, 1979.
Ooh, very nice, John. Congratulations.
All right. Woo. That was a close one. I think I finally compelled David to throw it, but I don't know. We will never know.
Never know.
If anybody asks, I'll tell them that the result was a great story, right? It's like Triple H being like, just keep enjoying the show.
Whether you believe that a trivia segment on a fucking wrestling podcast is real or not, I can't convince you otherwise.
It's like the Montreal screw job. We will never know if this is a work or a shoot or, you know.
Absolutely. So, congratulations to John Boucher, who has now successfully defeated every challenger that has stepped up except for one. The only man that has beat him and not had John beat him in a rematch is Chad Olson, who is an integral part of the Trigostez Hall of Fame induction weekend. So we will work to get Chad on the podcast next month, and I will explain to both of you my incredibly brilliant and genius plan to kill off the Charting the Territories podcast with some type of thing that has previously killed off at least one wrestling territory. So, David, thank you so much for joining us and talking about Lord Littlebrook and for being a team player one way or the other. in this challenge. But before you go, tell our listeners a little bit more about how to ace your comeback and your other writings and musings.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It was a blast to have you. I'm always here to do the right thing, you know. Thank you so much again for having me. It's always been a blast collaborating. I have to say, you mentioned earlier that, you know, we've worked together on your writing, Al, over the last couple of years. And like, I just wanted to say it's been an awesome journey and you've grown a lot. It used to be kind of that I wrote them and that you edited. And then by the end, it was like you wrote them and I edited, you know what I mean? So that was a cool thing to do together. I want to thank you for making me, you know, a part of the show and a part of the whole Charting the Territories experience. If people have any interest in reading my novella, How to Ace Your Comeback, it was written in 2021. If you didn't know that, you would probably think, oh, this guy's just writing about stuff that's played out over the last couple of years. But no, actually, it was written before all that drama happened. It's about a guy who's been away from the wrestling business for a really, really long time, trying to kind of rejoin things in the modern environment and finding that things have changed a whole lot in terms of the way people interact and treat each other and think about the business. So if that sounds interesting to you, you can check it out on Amazon, How to Ace Your Comeback, or aceyourcomeback.com is my website. Got a couple more stories, like Al said, that I worked on over the last couple of years that I originally released as serials. I'm in the process of bundling those together into a short story collection that I'm hoping to have out last fall. So keep your eyes peeled for that one. Thank you so much. I don't have any social media for you to follow me on, so don't try.
Yeah, that was one thing I noticed. You know, David and I used to communicate through the social media platform formerly known as Twitter. And one day he stopped, I would type in his handle and it stopped showing up. And I mailed him. I said, are you all right? He said, oh, I'm great because I'm no longer on social media. Good for you. Smart for you. So if you question David's intelligence, he is not on social media at all, which pretty much tells you he is smarter than all of us.
Yep.
So David, you're welcome to hang out and listen to the rest of the magic that John and I make every month here at Charting the Territories. But if not, it was an absolute pleasure. And again, thank you for everything you've done to help make Charting the Territories what it has become.
Yeah, of course. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. So last month, I mentioned that I had done some research using data from the Washington State Athletic Commission to answer the question, did the midgets draw more children than usual? Because one thing about Washington State's data, they actually break down number of tickets sold by tier. And oh, wow. They had a separate price tier for children.
That's cool.
So the conventional wisdom has always been that when the midgets were booked, more kids would come to the matches than would the rest of the time. And we're actually able to look at the data and show whether that was true or not. So this was done only using data from 1971 for the state of Washington. And in the state of Washington, most of the shows were run out of the Vancouver booking office, but some of them were run out of the Portland booking office as well. So there were a total of 92 house shows in the state of Washington in 1971. And on average, the percentage of tickets in the child price tier was 19.4%. However, what's interesting is there's a big difference between the Vancouver shows and the Portland shows, which is weird. And I can't come up with a good reason to explain it. When Vancouver had shows in Washington State, 16% of the tickets sold were in the kids tier. When Portland ran shows, it was a full 29.4%.
Huh.
So a big difference, but it averages out to about 19.4% of tickets sold were in the child's tier. Now, when we split those out between shows with midgets on the card and those without midgets, we do see a difference. And the Vancouver shows, in the shows without the midgets, 15.6% of tickets were kids. And in the shows with the midgets, 19.9%. So right there, there's about a 20 to 25% increase in the percentage of kids tickets. Now the Portland office, when they have shows without the midgets, the kids tier tickets made up 28.5% of total shows. When they did have the midgets, that went up to 33.6. So fully one out of every three tickets was a kid's ticket when the midgets were on the card. Now, one possible explanation I will give as to why the difference between the Vancouver and Portland offices was so significant. The Vancouver office was running the major cities in Seattle, in Washington, Seattle, Tacoma, etc. When Portland ran the state, they were running spot towns just barely outside of Portland, on the southern end of Washington State. So it's possible. One of the things we do know is that when, you know, territories ran the spot shows, they're often more family friendly, even if the midgets weren't on it. There's one of those things that you run a small town. You know, you always hear the population of the town was 1,000, but the wrestling show drew 1,200. So it is entirely possible that because they're running these smaller towns, this was just more of a bring your family out to the wrestling, whereas the Vancouver office was running Seattle and Tacoma, and those shows are happening midweek where it's harder to get the kids to come out because they have school the next day.
What is the, what are the age? What are we calling
children? That I do not know. That's a very good point. And there, in Vancouver, it was 12 and under.
Okay.
But for at least some of the Portland shows, it appears that's 14 and under.
Huh.
So that can explain at least some of the difference, the fact that the Portland had a higher percentage in that 13 and 14-year-olds are included in the kids tier for those shows, but not for Vancouver shows. So that's a hell of a question, John, and I'm glad I had the answer handy. and I'm also glad that I didn't see it so that you could bring it up. So it's clear that having the midgets booked on the show leads to a higher percentage of kids coming to the show. And so this proves one of the old adages slash wives' tales about pro wrestling. And of course, charting the territories is all about using actual data to prove or disprove these theories. And in this case, we proved it. But I have another question for you, John, about when the midgets would be booked. Which month or months do you think might have had the highest percentage of child tickets sold, and why? So do you think there's any seasonality to this?
I would imagine maybe summer, just because no school, or no.
All right. And David, you're still with us. Do you want to chime in and offer your thoughts on this one?
I would guess also maybe summer, and then maybe around the holidays as well, like when tickets might be going to stocking stuffers, things like that.
All right. So let's see what the data says. And this is overall percentage of tickets in the child tier. As we said earlier, it was 19.4%. The months with the highest percentage was July with 23.4%.
There we go.
August with 22.6%. So right there, those are the two summer months. And the third highest, November, with 20.6%. So, you know, you bring them around the week of Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
The kids are off for school. December, believe it or not, had a slightly lower than average percent. It was 18.9%. But absolutely, the summer months are when more kids attend shows because they are able to, because as we mentioned earlier, the territories are running six nights a week. And on a Tuesday or Wednesday, if it's a school night, it's hard to bring the kids. But in July and August, it is much easier. So one of the rare cases where things in pro wrestling actually make sense and the numbers do exactly what we thought that they would. Now, back to Lord Littlebrook, his in-ring career, as we mentioned, wound down. His last national television run was as manager of the royal family. But, John, you found a couple of newspaper articles profiling Lord Littlebrook. The first one was from the September 29th, 1985 edition of the St. Joseph Press. So this is his hometown paper doing an article on him. So, John, anything, we'll post this article on our social media, but is there any one thing that stood out to you about this in this article?
It's a lot of just like straight bio stuff, but there's one little tidbit where he talks about having some GI issues, having a colostomy bag for a while. And it's interesting to note that this is from September, late September 85. So this is before like the big WrestleMania So we see a lot of there's a quite a period of time when there's no results for him at all.
Right.
And that sort of that sort of, you know, this might be that.
Yes, this lines up. This might offer an explanation as to why there's that brief gap and then he picks up again. Even though he's winding down his career, there is that large gap with nothing, as opposed to most of the time when there's
it actually talks about, you know, an injury that's ended his career. So at this point, they're writing about him as if his career is over. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Also in this article, it mentions that Gus Karras, who is the promoter in St. Joseph, not just of wrestling, but also anytime like the Globetrotters or the circus came to town. Gus was the one who helped convince him to relocate to St. Joseph, with Littlebrook saying it's a hell of a lot easier to go from, say, St. Joe to the East Coast than it is to get there from Los Angeles. This sort of validates that theory that they are driving to most of the places they're booked, and that the idea of being centrally located was a selling point.
Yeah.
Because as someone who's been to that part of the country, there's not a whole lot of other selling points about living in Kansas or parts of Missouri.
No disrespect.
Yes, no disrespect. Mm-hmm. The second article, John, is from the May 22nd, 1999, Kansas City Star.
Yep.
And so again, is there any, and this, the title is Lord Littlebrook of St. Joe, but then the, I guess the subtitle, even though it's above the title, is A Giant in the Ring.
Yeah, this is a, they've got a great photo, and I don't know if I've ever seen this photo before, of him in his little ring that he trained people in. It's just like him, you know, standing in there, and you see there's no ropes or anything on it. Yep. Just, you know, just hanging out there. again, mostly just a straight biography. My favorite line from this one was where he, you know, the reporter asked him what was the proudest moment of his life. And he's like, so far, probably being married to a 6'4" underwater stripper.
Yeah, so that paragraph goes, because I wanted to mention that. So the high point of his life, or so he says, was a wondrous love affair with a beautiful 6'4" underwater stripper who used to carry him out of the bars they frequented, coyly announcing that she was going to tuck him in.
Yes.
And she did that, he said. Oh, yes, I did all right with wrestling.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, an interesting note that I found in this article, by and large, most stories about Eric Tovey's life says that he joined the circus after running away from an abusive father. But here he says that he told his dad he was joining the circus because he couldn't get any other job. And his dad then bought him a suitcase and helped him pack. Hmm. So in all likelihood, the truth is probably somewhere the midpoint between those two stories. And there's, I would say both of them are true in part. Eric Tovey, a.k.a. Lord Littlebrook, passed away on September 9th, 2016. But as we often do on Charting the Territories, we don't just want to focus on one wrestler. We want to talk about some of the other little persons who were active in the early 1970s. So I put together a list of the 10 most active male performers from 1971 through 1973. And I'm going to go through them in alphabetical order. And John or I will have some fun facts about these men. So first up is Bobo Johnson. Now, on January 2nd, 1976 in Houston, Bobo faced Lord Littlebrook in a singles match. But then both of them were in a two-ring, 22-man battle royal along with Andre the Giant, Ernie Ladd, Stan Hansen, and others.
Oof.
The Royal was won by the Mongolian Stomper, which leads me to believe that the thing was a shoot. next up is Cowboy Lang.
Cowboy Lang, over the course of his career, teamed with numerous NWA, WWWF, and AWA champions. We've got records of him teaming with, among others, Luthez, Pat O'Connor, Barry Windham, Pedro Morales, Stan Stasiak, Rick Martel, Larry Zbyszko, and Jerry Lawler.
Wow. Next up, Frenchie Lamont.
He had a small role as a carnival wrestler in a movie called Days of Heaven, a 1978 film starring a young Richard Gere, Brooke Adams, Sam Shepard, and Linda Manns.
Next up on the list is the Haiti Kid, real name Raymond Kessler. He was born in New Rochelle, New York. Other pro wrestlers born in New Rochelle include Devon Dudley and his two sons, but perhaps the most famous person born in New Rochelle to have participated in a pro wrestling match is Jay Leno.
Huh.
Who, of course, had that fabulous, fabulous match for WCW.
Yes.
Next up is Little Bruiser. Now, in 1972 in Indianapolis, Little Bruiser worked in a six-man tag teaming with Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher against the Blackjacks and Bobby Heenan. During the match, Blackjack Mulligan slammed Little Bruiser off the top rope, and Bruiser, Little Bruiser, did a stretcher job. According to Mulligan, the day after it aired on TV, he says he walked into a 7-Eleven and the woman working there spit on him and said, "We don't want your business in here, people like you."
That's fantastic.
Next up is Little Brutus, real name Jean-Jacques Girard. Ooh. He was born in Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu, Quebec, which was also the birthplace of current WWE star Kevin Owens. Next up is the primary subject of this month's podcast, Lord Littlebrook, followed by Sky Lolo.
Sky Lolo was one of the original four of the Little People wrestlers, along with Tom Thumb, who we talked about earlier, Pee Wee James, and Tiny Rowe, all of whom were Canadians.
Next on the list, Sonny Boy Hayes.
Sonny Boy Hayes actually has a pretty big role in a 1972 cult film, Scarecrow in a Garden of Cucumbers. He plays the romantic interest, sort of semi-romantic interest maybe, of Warhol superstar Holly Woodlawn. And you might know Holly Woodlawn from Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side. She is the Holly who came from Miami, FLA. Yeah. And the Haiti Kid, Raymond Kessler, is also in the movie in a wrestling scene with Sonny Boy Hayes.
What's the name of the movie again?
Scarecrow in a Garden of Cucumbers.
Okay. Finally, the 10th on the list of the 10 most active wrestlers in the early 70s, the 10 most active male midget wrestlers, was Wee Willie Wilson. Now, in the early days of the 605 Super Podcast, Wee Willie Wilson achieved notoriety based on comments from Sue Shooter, a.k.a. Sue the Shooter, who said he was strange in his sexual ways and was very well hung. As an aside, Sue Shooter actually passed away in January of this year.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. So we talked about the male midget wrestlers, but of course we cannot forget the women. The two most prevalent in the early 70s, of course, were first up, Darling Dagmar.
After getting married in the late 70s, Dagmar retired from the ring and went to work for South Carolina Educational TV, a public television station.
And then her most frequent opponent, Diamond Lil. So of Diamond Lil's 1,326 documented matches on WrestlingData.com, a full 1,164 of them, or about 88%, featured Dagmar on the other side of the ring.
Wow.
In those matches with known results, Diamond Lil won just 10% of the time. Actually, 10.5% of the time. Now, so while they were career opponents, they did team up on at least a few occasions, including during a 1975 stint in the Maritimes, where they faced the team of Honey Girl Page and Princess Little Dove.
Huh.
There's also an obituary on Slam Wrestling, which we've talked about earlier, and we've referenced some of our facts came from there. I'll post a link to it. Interesting tidbit I took from this article. Even when Littlebrook trained the full-size wrestlers, Ed Wiskoski, Butch Reed, and others, it was done in a smaller ring that was specifically designed to train the midget wrestlers.
Hmm.
So that just about wraps it up for this month. Again, another interesting look at a group of wrestlers that aren't talked about as much as the primary territorial era wrestlers, and that was the midgets and their troop led by Lord Littlebrook. As I mentioned earlier, next month on the podcast, we're going to have the first of a two-part look into the pro wrestling career of Bobby Shane. And first up in August, we will focus on the first half of his career when he was a clean-cut babyface, often billed as a boy wonder. And in September, we will cover his years as a heel, where he was the self-proclaimed king of professional wrestling. Before we leave you this month, it's time for This Month I Learned, where both John and I name one new thing we learned over the course of our research over the last 30 or so days. So, John, what did you learn this month?
So in the course of looking for Littlebrook stuff in the newspapers, I came across an article from the St. Joseph, Missouri News Press from 1996 that basically a brief history of pro wrestling in the city. The reporter was all the way back to Gus Karras, Orville Brown. Flipping through to find the rest of the article, I found a smaller secondary article about the local wrestling legends of St. Joseph. And Littlebrook, of course, is the first one mentioned. Got some quotes from him, and they mention another St. Joseph, Missouri legend, the Junkyard Dog. They even have a big mid-80s promo photo of JYD in the article. I had no idea that JYD had roots or such a deep connection with St. Joseph, Missouri, so I read a little more, get to a paragraph that says, Roy Creighton, who came to St. Joseph in the days of Harold Cagle, never had a wrestling match at the old auditorium, but he shot to fame in the WWF as the Junkyard Dog. So he, too, is part of our wrestling legacy. So first things first, Harold Cagle was a football coach at Missouri Western State University in the early 70s. Roy Creighton was a 6'6", 260-pound defensive tackle who was originally from Fulton, Mississippi. Being as familiar with Junkyard Dog and Sylvester Ritter as you and I and most of our listeners are, I don't think any of us would mistake Roy Creighton for Sylvester Ritter. Yeah. But if JYD needed a stunt double in a movie role, Roy Creighton would indeed be a great choice. So I'm sitting here trying to scratch my head, you know, figuring out what sort of alternate timeline I have accidentally fallen into. So I kept looking for more newspaper stuff about Roy Creighton and JYD. And the earliest reference I could find to this mix-up was over a decade earlier, in October of 1984, in an article written by the same reporter, in which he was reporting the 10-year reunion of the Missouri Western State football team. And the headline of the article was, Junkyard Dog Couldn't Make It. And they all talk about missing Creighton, who came from somewhere down south, and after leaving the football program, turned to pro wrestling. Now he's a main event mat star wrestling in places like Atlanta and Madison Square Garden. And last time I saw him, he was driving a big Cadillac with a custom license plate that read Big Roy. And Harold Cagle, who we mentioned, everyone I knew on that first team became a success. Junkyard Dog sure missed a real happening. So Roy Creighton, as far as I know, had nothing to do ever with pro wrestling, at least not under his real name. But he was a power lifter of note. So you see his name pop up in papers for that sort of stuff, and you can find all sorts of his powerlifting records. So various streets of strength on the web.
So do we think that Mr. Creighton was fibbing and saying he was the Junkyard Dog, or do we think that perhaps his nickname as a football player was the Junkyard Dog, and this reporter maybe just somehow went on his own little and assumed that he was the wrestler?
I was thinking of a third option.
Okay.
Where people just saw this guy and was like, oh, yeah, I remember him from, he was on our football team. That's Roy Creighton.
And the legend grew. Just like how every time I talk to someone in the real world and mention pro wrestling, they say, oh, my cousin was the second Ultimate Warrior, you know, or something like that.
But it's interesting how back in 1984, stuff like this can make it into a print publication, and that legend or rumor would persist.
Right, for
a decade.
Yeah.
Plus.
Yeah. So this month I learned, we'll be talking next month about Bobby Shane. So I was doing some research on his second run in Georgia, which was in 67, 68. I came across an article from the Columbus, Georgia newspaper discussing the infamous incident where Tim Woods had part of his finger bitten off during a grandstand challenge against local hooligan Arnold Sperlin. The article goes into great detail about the incident and how it got fans, some of whom were Sperlin's friends, riled up. So this was a grandstand challenge, but they actually announced on the weekend TV that Arnold Sperlin, a local guy, was going to be the one challenging Tim Woods, as opposed to just the grandstand challenge and then either show whoever raises their hand. This was something that was actually built up because I guess Sperlin was notorious in Columbus and probably not in a good way. But During this incident, two fans were arrested after fighting with officers and allegedly pulling a knife on a witness to the brawl. The witness's name, Leon Baxter. John, do we know a Leon Baxter?
That's the wrestling pro, is it not?
Yes, and the wrestling pro, also known as Tarzan Baxter, and guess what? He was wrestling here under a mask at the time. So probably as the fans were getting riled up and the wrestlers needed to come from the back to help save Tim, the heels, in order to protect kayfabe, probably couldn't. But if they were wearing a mask, they could just take their mask off and nobody knew who they were. So my guess is that's what happened here. So he had wrestled as one of the masked gauchos and actually wrestled against Bobby Shane and Johnny Walker.
So we have Johnny Walker too. We have all these future masked guys.
It's so funny because it happens more often than you think. When I go through these results and I see Johnny Walker unmasked on a card with Tim Woods on it, you know, you don't really realize that they cross paths numerous times in numerous places, and in some cases were teammates and on a couple of times probably wrestled against one another long before Walker became Mr. Wrestling 2 and in things that were not acknowledged as part of the creation of Mr. Wrestling 2. So that does it for this month on the podcast. You can purchase one or more of my 6 books on Amazon.com now through the about mid-December. They'll be available on Amazon.com worldwide. While supplies last or up to mid-December, you can also buy them at chartingtheterritories.com if you live in the continental U.S. If you're coming to Waterloo, Iowa in mid-July, I'll have my books for sale. And if you sweet talk me and have cash, I might be able to swing you a deal on the books, but I did reduce the price of the books online down from $21.99 to $19.99 each. There will be no further reductions. If I end up still having books on hand, I'm not going to, you know, just discount them to get rid of them. I truly think that's unfair to our to the folks that have been buying the books from the beginning. So we're going to keep the prices as they are. You can find me on Blue Sky, algetz.bsky.social. You can also find the Charting the Territories page on Facebook. And as part of the build-up to Waterloo this year, I appeared on Shotgun Wrestling Radio a few weeks back to talk about Waterloo with Zach Takis. My episode was sandwiched in between episodes featuring Chris Owens, one of the preeminent historians on Andre the Giant, as well as longtime independent wrestling promoter Herb Simmons. You can find Shotgun Wrestling Radio on all podcast platforms and on YouTube. And I also appeared on episode 514 of Between the Sheets with Chris Zellner and David Bixenspan, where we covered 1 week in 1985, and I got off a tasteless joke at the expense of one Kerry Von Erich. What can I say? So, John, where can our listeners find more of your musings and rantings?
Yes, unlike David Gibb, I am an idiot, and I'm on social media. You can find me at Blue Sky, johnboucher.bsky.social, john.boucher on X, John Boucher on Facebook. My email contact is on X and Blue Sky. If you want to contact me, that's the best way.
Of course, you have another podcast that you are a part of.
Yes. Outlaws to Independence, our last episode, Bo James and I take a look back at the month of June 1981 and 1982 on the Outlaws and Independence scene.
That's amazing. I didn't realize there how much independent wrestling there was prior to, you know, the early 90s. But yeah, you guys keep digging up more and more of these things. And half of them involve Burt Prentice somehow.
Yes. And next, I think our next episode will involve Burt Prentice very heavily.
Of course it will. So the most recent season of Dark Side of the Ring wrapped up. But John, any word on another season or any other outside projects that you are working on?
I have not heard anything about a new season, but I am not high enough up on the chain to be aware if it's happening or not. Okay. But I have heard nothing myself. I have no outside projects at the moment. I am just coasting through life.
Just coasting through life.
Got the summer off, baby.
Yes, having the summer off. Yes. All right. Well, that's wonderful. And of course, you will be missed in Waterloo.
Yes.
But as I said, I'm going to try and get Chad on the podcast next month, because now, you know, we have some unfinished business, and I think we need to end this podcast in September with perhaps the most shocking trivia segment in the history of this podcast.
Wow.
The Charting the Territories podcast comes out on the second Thursday of the month. To be the first to know when new episodes are available, subscribe now wherever you find your favorite podcasts and at chartingtheterritories.com. Also want to thank David Gibb for joining us.
Yes,
he's actually still here hanging around. He's lurking in the background. So say goodbye one more time, David.
Thanks so much for having me. Goodbye.
And John, I'll miss you in Waterloo, but yes. I will talk to you next month.
Yes. See you in August.